prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review and spoil underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm your co-host, Erica, joined by co-host Lance.
Hey, everyone.
So before we get into the movie for this episode, a couple things. First of all, a shout out to Jason from the Direct to VHS podcast, who wrote us a new review on Apple Podcasts. And it was specifically one that we requested. His review, quote, "Erica is dead inside. Lance is a champ." Thank you for your review. Both of those statements are true.
Yeah, that's our tagline from now on. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And then also another thank you and a hello to all of our new listeners in India. Hello and thanks for listening.
Hello, everybody from India.
All right. And then next, it's been a couple episodes since we've done this physical media segment specifically. So it was Black Friday recently, and I know I spent a lot of money. I'm sure Lance bought a few things too.
It's true. Yeah. Every year.
Every year I tell myself, like, I'm only going to get this many. And then I get on the site and I'm like, let's do this too. And then I find out about another sale and I'm like, oh, I should do that too, because that's a great deal. So, oh man.
I kind of held back this year.
Okay. I would have, except that a few days before Black Friday, we found out that we were getting a extra bonus at work as a like, hey, sorry, COVID sucks. Here's some money from our job. So I was like, sweet. So I spent some money. I did three different sales. I did Warner Archive was having a 4 for $44 sale. So I got four movies from there. I got four movies from Severin, The Black Cat, which is episode 2. Everyone can go back and listen to that.
Hell yes.
Patrick Still Lives, Shock Treatment, because I needed to see Alain Delon's penis in high definition, and Blood on Satan's Claw. And then Vinegar Syndrome, I looked at my email receipts, orders, and I got 17 movies from Vinegar Syndrome.
Well done. Do you do the checklist on their site at all?
No, I don't. I should.
Just, yeah. I mean, I think it's fun.
Yeah. I do love stuff like that too. I love checklists. So, I'm not going to go through all the movies that I bought, just a few offhand. I got one of their newer releases, Fade to Black, I Start Counting, The Immortalizer, Blue Vengeance, Corruption, and then another double feature that is by the director of the movie that we're talking about tonight, Primeval and Lurker's Double, and The Telephone Book, and a bunch more, but I'm not going to, you know, take our whole episode up and list off all the movies I spent my money on. What did you pick up this Black Friday?
I picked up a few from Vinegar Syndrome. I got all three of Mexican director Ruben Galindo Jr.'s supernatural slashers, nice. Cemetery of Terror, Don't Panic, and Grave Robbers. And Don't Panic was one of the best theater experiences I've ever had. It was programmed, like, I think it was in 2018 for Terror Tuesday. And I loved the crowd, the movie, how Joe set it up. It was, I can't wait to watch it at home.
I missed that one in 2018. And I have seen it though, like since then, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm bummed because I can definitely see how that would have been a hit with Terror Tuesday.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, I don't know. I'm anxious to watch it again. Well, I won't be sober. I think that's why I just enjoy it so much. I think all his movies are going to be a blast to just watch at home, just, you know, shit-faced and you know, high on having these movies in my house, I guess.
Yeah, there you go.
I also picked up Sometimes Aunt Martha Does Dreadful Things, the ACFA release.
Nice.
Which I think ACFA had already released them, but this has a new commentary track with queer film historian who's a local, Evan Purchell.
Oh, nice. I didn't know he had a track on that. That's neat.
Yeah. And ACFA's Brett Berg is also doing commentary. So I'm excited to dive into that.
Cool.
And I picked up one from Severin, Vampiros Lesbos, which I haven't owned, and I need to own it, so I picked it up. And then a random one I grabbed was Brad Henderson from Vinegar Syndrome. He tweeted that SRS Cinema had recently sold out of Tim Ritter's shot on video Truth or Dare mm-hmm. on Blu-ray, and apparently they released some just for Black Friday, so I picked up one of those.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Ritter followed it up with Truth or Dare with Killing Spree, which was another magnificent Terror Tuesday theater experience. So I'm excited to check out Truth or Dare.
Nice.
That's it. I just picked up those six.
I should have shown more restraint, but I mean.
I did better this year than last year. I think I picked up like, I don't know, probably about, I was in double digits with Vinegar Syndrome, I think.
Oh, wow. So yeah.
I had to hold back a little.
Okay. I think I'm good for a very long time. I don't need to buy any. I say that, but I literally just bought the 4K Total Recall today because I desperately wanted to see the documentary about Carol Co. I need to stop myself at some point.
It's about the special features now. I mean, that's.
Yeah, that's the thing. So anyway, I'll report back on the Carol Co documentary on the Total Recall. I do love the movie too, so I'm not like adverse to like owning the movie, but I was just like, ooh, I want to watch that. And it was like $12. So anyway.
Oh, nice. Steal. That's, yeah. You're not even buying it.
Exactly. I'm, you know, I'm coming out ahead, folks. Okay, so getting into our movie for this episode, it is my turn to pick, and we are discussing a criminally underseen Christmas horror movie, because Christmas is this week.
Yep.
And we are doing 1985's The Oracle.
Jennifer's new apartment was vacant, but it wasn't empty. An ancient device of unspeakable power awaits her.
She talked with dead people, with ghosts. And one day, she just disappeared. You move into her apartment.
Jennifer was desired and then seduced. Now the horror begins, and no one can stop it. She doesn't know the danger it will foretell, or the evil it will unleash.
This is available to watch on YouTube, and there is also a DVD out there, but I would actually hold out for a Blu-ray if you're super interested in it. Besides that, number of Letterboxd views as of this recording, 347.
That's way too low.
Okay, good. I'm glad you liked it. I wanted to get that out of the way first because I purposely did not peek on Letterboxd because I was really like, I was like, I'm like 95% confident that Lance is going to love this movie too. But I was like, there's a small chance that it could just not land with him. So I'm glad to hear that and get that out of the way. So
I loved it. But yeah, more people need to see this for sure. Like a release, a Blu-ray release sometime.
I hope so. I'm sure it will. Her movies are, a lot of her movies are starting to get that. Vinegar Syndrome has, speaking of Vinegar Syndrome, has quite a few of hers. Mostly the adult films, but we'll get into that. Okay, so The Oracle, put it on your Christmas viewing list. This is what it's about. So after Jennifer and her husband move into the apartment formerly occupied by a medium, Jennifer takes possession of one of the old woman's items, which allows her to communicate with spirits. Unlike a traditional Ouija board, though, this has a ceramic blue hand, a feathered pen, and paper on which the spirit can write messages. On Christmas Eve, Jennifer gets a message from William Graham, whom she later finds out from his widow has committed suicide a few weeks prior. The spiritual connection between Jennifer and William Graham escalates past just written notes to his spirit possessing her so that she sees that he was in fact murdered and did not commit suicide. Jennifer goes to Graham's widow to share this information, describing her husband's murder and assailants in detail. What Jennifer does not know is that the assailants work for the widow and they are now after her to stop her from discovering the truth. I'm not going to... okay, so this is directed by Roberta Finlay. Now, it's difficult to summarize her career and like... you could talk about Roberta Finlay in a whole other podcast episode just about her. And there's actually a few good interviews out there. So if you're interested in learning more about Roberta Finlay after hearing us kind of talk about her a little bit and about this movie, I would recommend a few other podcasts. First of which is the Rialto Report podcast. Ashley West interviews her. It's about a 2-hour interview, and he gets probably more out of her than most people do as far as information goes. There's also the Slums of Film History and Important Cinema Club podcasts, and they go through her film career, sort of film by film in a little bit more depth. She also did a more recent interview with Gear Club podcast, and something that you're going to hear frequently from her in not just that podcast, but any interview, really, if you find any on YouTube or anything like that, is that she thinks her fans are crazy for liking her films and doesn't understand why anyone cares about her. And so she's usually she answers very quickly and succinctly. She doesn't tend to elaborate very much on the questions that are asked of her and tends to sort of tell side stories when they come to her. And she's done some commentaries for her films, including this one, but her detachment is somewhat evident and her memory of making them is fairly hazy. So the commentary for this one, it's very much like that. And I do actually find that most commentaries by directors, they're not professionals at doing commentaries like Tim Lucas or Troy Holworth or Kat Ellinger, Sam Deegan. Like, they know how to fill up the space and when to talk about what and give a lot of different context about the actors and history and other films and stuff like that. This one was more just like, oh yeah, this guy and that. And I love that about her in this, let me be clear, but I'm just going to say like the commentary is not super great. For this
movie. She just wants the films to speak for themselves.
She just doesn't want to talk about it. She's like, right. Why are you watching this movie? No, she literally said in the commentary, she's like, God, I hope no one listens to this commentary. Just like, but she may not like doing commentaries, but she does enjoy part of making films. She didn't seek out getting into filmmaking. She just sort of fell into it with her late husband, Michael Finlay. And she has stated that she enjoys the more technical aspects of filmmaking, like editing, lighting, and photography, but that she hates directing, mostly because she hates actors who she called, quote, childish and needy.
Like, sounds like Argento.
Yeah, she even said, she's like, yeah, like, you know, Hitchcock said, they're cattle, they're props, who cares? It just, you know, you tell them what to do and then right. You move on. I'm like, oh, she's fantastic. So, so despite her adversity to making films, she actually directed 35 films and is credited with just over 50 where she was the cinematographer, a lot of which were with her husband, Michael Finlay. Now, Lance, I don't know how far down the wormhole you went with looking into Roberta and Michael Finlay. Did you read up anything about him?
No, I didn't. I watched Snuff.
Okay.
That was the only Michael Finlay. And I think she did this. Well, maybe she didn't do the cinematography.
She did go down to Argentina with them. And that was like they were just like handed her a camera and they're like, here, shoot. And she's like, okay.
Yeah, I think she is in one of those scenes too, like the very end scene that, you know, pulls in the whole camera crew. But
yeah.
That's the only one I watched, and I watched one of Roberta's films too, but I didn't go too far in the wormhole about Michael.
Okay. So He died in a very tragic accident. He was on top of the what used to be the Pan Am building in New York and was going to take a helicopter to the airport. The helicopter tipped over and the blade hit the ground and broke off. And a bunch of people, including Michael Finlay, were killed by the helicopter, like the destroyed helicopter blades that went flying and the pieces went everywhere, including a woman who was walking on the street down below the building. Like a piece came down and killed her.
Wow. I like how you got a chuckle in there.
I know. Sorry, it's awful, but it's also just like the most random fucking way to die. Like,
yeah, that's insane.
It's awful. But she and her husband were estranged at that point. She had left him and she had a few partners up until this man, Walter Sear, who is actually the composer on this film and worked with her and produced a number of the other films that she did after she left Michael. So as far as what I've seen from her, I've also seen Snuff. I've also seen Shriek of the Mutilated, both of those shot by Roberta, directed by Michael Finlay. I've seen A Woman's Torment, Tenement, and Primeval. You know, I mentioned the Vinegar Syndrome. They've got a number of her adult films released. Tenement has a Blu-ray out there. Blood Sisters, I believe, has one coming out soon from Media Blasters, but it's not out yet. And I think that's the one that you watched, Lance?
Yeah. I watched it mainly because of one of the characters in The Oracle was in it, Farkas. And we'll get to her, but I had to watch something else with that actress in it.
I love Farkas.
Yes.
So one other movie that she directed, one of the adult films that she directed, was called Shauna, Every Man's Fantasy. And I'm bringing this one up because we had a request in one of our reviews to cover the movie Black Roses, but that has over 1,000 views on Letterboxd, so it's ineligible. So this is for you, person who wrote that review. Shauna, Every Man's Fantasy, directed by Roberta Finlay, was written by John Fasano, who directed Black Roses.
Ah.
So there you go.
Black Roses is so fun. I think that was one of the last...
That was the Taps and Tape.
Taps and Tapes on Vulcan Video that a buddy of mine, Austin, and I went to. Mm. So good.
God, now I'm sad, Lance.
Remember when we could talk? Sorry.
Remember when we had video stores and went to movies? And
remember when you could see your friends and just... I would just stay at home and buy Blu-rays all day.
Yeah, that's all I do now. And... finally, the last film that she directed was called Banned. That's B-A-N-N-E-D, as in censored, 1988. And she's gone on record saying that she made it so poorly on purpose in order to lose money for a tax write-off that year. So Zach Carlson, he actually has a write-up about it in the book Destroy All Movies, A Complete Guide to Punks on Film, if you're lucky enough to own a copy of that out-of-print book. But, you know, maybe next time I see him in person at Alamo, I'll just be like, hey, tell me about Band.
Okay, yeah.
Because I don't have the book. Anyway, getting to the cast, pretty much everyone in this movie, this is their only acting credit. That includes Caroline Capers, our main character, who plays Jennifer. There are at least 5 men with mustaches in this movie. One of them is Chris de Coron, who plays the building maintenance manager, Papas. And I love him.
Yeah. He gave me mad Tom Savini vibes.
A Greek Tom Savini vibes.
Right.
I love him. And then Pam Latesta, who plays Farkas. And like Lance mentioned, she is also in Finlay's Blood Sisters, I believe, in a couple other of her movies. So... interesting fact about her, she showed up, Pam Latesta, showed up to the casting with her boyfriend at the time, her boyfriend is also in the movie. He is the very overweight man at the New Year's Eve.
Oh, yeah, on the balcony, yeah.
Yeah, that's Pam Latesta's boyfriend at the time. Both of them showed up to the casting call Finlay thought that she was a man at the casting until she started speaking. And, you know,
so Farkas was written as a man's role.
Correct. Right? Yeah. Okay. So Finlay thought she was a man at casting and was like, oh, this guy looks like he would be great, you know, for the part. And then she spoke, she finds out that no, Letesta is actually a housewife from Queens with three kids. So Finlay was like, ah, fuck it. We'll just cast her. Well, she can play a man. It's fine. So Finlay ends up casting her to play the male role, but Letesta protested and said, no, I want to be treated like a woman. So Finlay changed the hit man character to a lesbian, but it's still kind of ambiguous due to another change that Finlay made. So I know you probably noticed that her voice is really weird in the movie. Yeah. So Finlay added they changed her voice afterwards. Like, she's got a very natural, like, sweet voice in the movie. And they added a pitch changer so it didn't sound like a man or a woman.
It sounded like a pitch changer.
It just doesn't sound like any gender, really. So it's this sort of ambiguous character, which is just, it's just one of those things in this movie that it's such an odd choice, but it's part of, like, the big part of the charm of this movie as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I mentioned before the score was done by her partner at the time, Walter Sear. The screenwriter was R. Allen Leader, though Finlay rewrote about half of the movie. He only has a few other writing credits. Most of them are adult films, and a couple of those are ones which Finlay has actually directed, Liquid Assets from 1982 and Glitter from 1983. Now, allegedly, very loudly, allegedly, in her commentary for this movie, Finlay said that Leader was arrested for child molestation. But I could not find anything to confirm that, so I'm leaving it at the screenwriter was allegedly arrested for child molestation. And then finally, with the effects, during an interview about the film on the DVD, she cited Tom Brumberg as doing the special effects, but he is not listed on either IMDb or Letterboxd, and the credits just say that the effects are done by a group called Horror EFX, so unconfirmed as to who did the magnificent effects in this movie, but she did also mention that her partner, Walter Sear, helped out with some of them, but I assume that he probably just went to the costume shop and bought giant monster hands and wacky wall crawlers. Oh, I love this movie. Sorry.
Yeah, it's so good.
We'll get into more of the film, including our thoughts about it, right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
So I already mentioned a couple of the things that Finlay brought up during the commentary. Specifically that, you know, she said, oh, like, I hope nobody ever hears this commentary. There's also a sex scene between Jennifer and her husband. And I thought it was really funny that she's like, oh my God, this is terrible. Like, and it was funny because it's like, well, yeah, she directs adult films and she's watching this and she's like, oh, this is terrible. I can't believe, like, oh, I can't believe I made this. And it's really cute to, like, hear her just rag on her own movie. But she did say that part of the inspiration for this movie was Rosemary's Baby, and that she does really like that film. She likes that it's modest and tells a story. And so at the very opening of The Oracle, the exterior building that's shot there is called the Dakota, which is a famous building. So just like how Rosemary's Baby was shot in a famous building, Finlay wanted to do the same thing for The Oracle. A couple other fun facts. The planchette is moved by a magnet underneath. And so the whoever was under there, usually it was Walter, her partner, the person under there actually tried writing words. So they were upside down and having to write backwards with a magnet, which is why the writing looks like essentially like chicken scratch, because that's someone trying to write backwards upside down.
Yeah, they do a good job, though. I mean, that's and also I got to point out, I've never really used the word planchette. And I think I'm going to try and work it into pretty much every conversation, at least one conversation at a party. I just love the word planchette.
There's no shortage of the usage of that word in this movie either, because they were like, well, we can't, they couldn't get a license. They couldn't afford to pay. It was the Parker Brothers, I think, made the Ouija boards. They couldn't afford that. So they're like, fuck it, we're just going to use this thing. And it's actually much more interesting for that. So
yeah, totally. Just the hand with the quill. It's a good touch.
I like it. When there is the scene in the mental hospital, most of the patients in there are primarily the crew. There is a adorable little armadillo in the scene where it's very windy inside her apartment and blowing around. And she pointed that out. She was like, oh, I bought that armadillo when I was in Argentina when we shot Snuff. I was like, okay.
The first time I watched that, I had to back it up because I was like, did that thing move? Because that was the first indication of some sort of supernatural powers.
Yeah.
And also, is that an armadillo? I had to double check that.
Yeah. We're very excited about the armadillo folks because, you know, we're in Texas. So, you know, we don't miss them in movies when they come up. So
it's like camping in Garner State Park.
A couple other things from her commentary. When Jennifer is watching TV in bed and there is a movie on television, that's actually one of Finlay's other films, A Woman's Torment, which... highly recommend. It's a great movie. Vinegar Syndrome has it on Blu-ray if you're interested.
That was a question I had written down.
What movie is that?
Yeah, I knew you'd have the answer.
Of course. And then finally, last fun fact, the actor who played the occult shop owner that Jennifer goes and talks to, he had Alzheimer's. And so he was actually in every scene reading off of cue cards.
Wow.
Because he couldn't remember any lines whatsoever.
he had a lot of lines for a short scene, too.
Yeah. I guess the real life occult shop owner gave Finlay a copy of the Black Mass book and was like talking to her about it. And she was like, yeah, okay, whatever. But I guess she actually ended up, she did end up actually having a Black Mass scene in one of her next movies, Primeval. So she got some inspiration from the guy who owned that lovely little shop.
The Magical Child, I think it was called.
Yes. Child with an E, child E, like shop, right. Like ice cream shoppy. Okay. So Lance, you said it earlier that you did really like this movie. What are some things that stood out to you? What did you like?
Well, aside from everything you've already mentioned, because this movie is just like a joy to watch. But those scenes that you already pointed out, her escaping from the hospital, and then that, you know, the guys like straight out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the patients are walking around. And then what was another scene that you had mentioned? The sex scene. So I noticed in Finlay's filming, a lot of these action sequences and tense situations, they're scenes that would like usually be glamorized by filmmakers, you know, to make it feel like you're at the movies, you know, typically going over the top for an audience reaction. But with those scenes and a few other examples that I have, her films, like these types of scenes just have this matter of factness approach. Like if they're very nonchalant, almost like a nothing to see here, please move along attitude. And it, from her interviews, it kind of sounds like she feels that way.
Yeah.
But I love it. To me, it like displays confidence in how she treats the script. It's like how to make supernatural elements feel like it's real life, which really works. And, you know, due in part to the awkwardness of it all and like not overbearing a fake sense of action and hype of the situation, it becomes kind of, I mean, it's very endearing, but it just seems very real. Like it seems like if that happened, if all this happened in real life, if Ray's head gets pulled off by some sort of creature in the incinerator, this is how it would play out. Like he's half-ass yelling, you know, he's trying to get away. But yeah, there's those scenes. In the very beginning, we'll talk about Farkas, who I think steals the show here.
But, yeah.
She's killing a prostitute in the very opening scene. And it's like this violent murder scene where the prostitute's tied up and Farkas is like casually pulling out a knife and telling her to lick the blade, you know, with little ease, very nonchalantly, just slices her from chin to belly, just with no warning. Like, you know, she's done this before in these great stabbing scenes. But it's just like, okay, next scene. You know, it doesn't spend a whole lot of time or just real effort just emphasizing everything that's kind of happening.
Yeah, everything just like moves from like one thing to the next. Like the prostitute picks up Farkas. The next scene, they're in the room, prostitute's tied up, Farkas on top. Farkas kills the prostitute, then goes and cleans the knife off in the bathroom and leaves.
Yeah, and as she's cleaning off the knife, Silent Night's playing over the murder scene and everything. It's just real. It's a very maniac feel. Like this feel like a Bill Lustig moment, though. Mm-hmm. It's not nearly as gritty, obviously, but there's a lot of fun murders. And like most of these action scenes that are happening, I think Finlay does a really good job of just kind of pulling out the awkwardness of it all and making it feel real to me. And that's just like the Farkas chasing Jennifer in a car on the sidewalk, and Jennifer runs into a museum. She makes sure she buys a ticket. And then it's just, you know, she's being chased in the museum, and it's just basically you're just heard us walking fast. You know, it's like a real chase scene. It's not very exaggerated, which a lot of filmmakers would do. Like, this is a chase scene. All right, let's really narrow in on enough. Finlay's like, no, she's just going to walk around and be kind of scared.
Yeah.
It really works for me. But that sex scene is just so awkward. I think Finlay must have pulled like, okay, let's shoot from here, from behind their head. Okay, let's go down to their armpit level. It's just like just this crazy, weird angled kissing going on.
Yeah, she said in the commentary that, well, there's a couple things about those two actors. So one, the woman who played Jennifer, Caroline Capers, she was like, I'm not going to do any nudity. So you never see any nudity from her. Mm-hmm. B, she had a very psychotic, jealous boyfriend. And so apparently she was very nervous about doing anything like that. And so I'm sure that nervousness sort of came through with that scene. And then she ended up telling her boyfriend because she felt guilty about the scene, even though she's acting. And her boyfriend kicked her out for doing that scene, for making out with another actor. And then
her boyfriend is basically her husband in the movie Ray, who is a complete fucking asshole.
Yeah, he sucks. And anyway, the guy who played Ray, he initially was like, he also said, I'm not doing any nude scenes. And he also included taking off his shirt as a nude scene. But apparently Finlay did convince him to, take off your shirt. Getting crazy over here. So I had to deal with a couple of prudes making this movie after coming off of making a lot of adult films. I'm sure she was not happy with those actors. So
yeah. Even in that sex scene, Jennifer, the actress playing Jennifer, is giving these, they're so unenthusiastic. It's just this, it's just like these, there's no moans. It's just like, I just loved it. I loved the awkwardness of all these, you know, they're real scenes. Like, you know, they could happen in real life, but even the supernatural elements are just, I don't know. I loved how Finlay handled them.
Yeah. So getting back to like, you know, the shitty husband. So one of my, you know, the two main things that I love in this movie are the side characters and the effects, aside from like just the movie as a whole. Like I love like what you said, how it doesn't try to be fancy. It's just like straightforward and matter of fact. And how you see that for me, most of all, is through the side characters. So the first, I'm going to group them all together. The shitty husband and the mustachios, we'll call them. They're just all one collective man because they all have just the same mustache. The husband is fucking awful and sucks. But it makes sense in the context of the movie because it's like you have a woman who is dealing with a supernatural event. So of course, like she's being treated like a child by her husband. There's one scene where she cooks him breakfast and like she puts down his eggs in front of him and he doesn't even fucking eat it. He just like puts his newspaper on top of him and leaves. I'm like,
yeah. After telling her to get him a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Dick. Anyway.
Yeah. He's definitely asshole husband of the century.
Yeah. But he gets it in the end. And so that sort of leads me to like the effects of it. So Jennifer ends up in the mental hospital, of course. The husband finds the box, which has the planchette hand and the feather pen and the paper and everything. And he's like, oh, hell no, this isn't staying in my house. So he takes it to the incinerator to throw away. And one thing that happens a lot in this movie effects-wise is green light, which I love. It's like this gel-like, it's just, it's beautiful. And it's simple, but it also yeah. works really well in this. So he opens the incinerator, green light comes out, monster hands that you probably buy at like
Spirit of Halloween or Walmart or something.
Exactly. There's these really bad monster hands that come out and like grab his head and shake it. And then he gets decapitated and dies. And it's fantastic. I love this. I love effects like that where it's like, well, we don't have much of a budget to work with, so what can we do? And yet it still turns out to be like so much fun and so effective. The green lighting also shows up when there is a Graham's skeleton, which
yeah, William Graham,
the dead spirit who's communicating with Jennifer through the planchette. There's like a flying skull that goes through the glass in the hospital, and like flying glass goes and gets one of the murderers. Or flying
who has glass, a mustache, by the way.
Yeah, another mustache. Every fucking man has a mustache in them. So, and then also like when he's in the car. And also when Farkas dies. So, oh, spoiler. Sorry, Farkas dies, guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a scene where Farkas is chasing Jennifer through this industrial building. She's chasing her with an axe. And there's a scene with Graham's skeleton shrouded in that green light. And Farkas is holding the axe. And she goes to swing at the skeleton. And of course, you know, it doesn't hit the skeleton, like, because it's not really there. It hits a tin drum of some kind of chemical that sprays on Farkas, who then melts.
Yeah. It's right out of Batman. I mean, like, the neon goo that pops out. It's yeah. like you're watching, you know, the Joker fall into some sort of acid. But yeah, it's and it's funny because when Graham's weird, decrepit skeleton, you know, it looks kind of like a creepy Fraggle Rock kind of like creature, like you can see it just kind of hanging there. There's, you know, nobody's in a suit. It's just, there's some scenes I think in the car where somebody is in the suit from like back shots, but this is just like straight up just a fake decrepit dead body. He just pops out and Farkas, who is one of the killers who killed Graham. I think you already said that, but mm-hmm. yeah, she's like, I killed you once, I'll kill you again, with that weird voice. Yeah. And she just blindly swings an axe and it's a pretty gnarly gore there because, yeah, the face melts and there's Farkas on the ground. And it's just this, you know, great angle shot from the floor of like just this meaty face with like a open eye and just this busted hamburger helper face. It's really good.
It's fantastic. The William Graham skeleton, it just came to me what it reminded me of when in Beetlejuice. They get killed again.
Where they're doing the seance and going mm-hmm. old. Yeah.
That's exactly what that skeleton looks like. And that was, according to Finlay, was created or made by Brumberg, who she's talked about in the commentary. Unconfirmed, though. So then the best death, my favorite death, though, is Pappas. And so yeah. Pappas is the building manager. He's just this, like, he's just so, like, happy and just, like, oh, yeah, and helpful and, like, but he's also so funny because he ends up taking the box down to the basement and he's opening it up and I think, was he trying to get, like, lottery numbers or something out of it, I think?
Yeah, he was basically, because that scene opens up where he's listening to the lottery numbers and he lost. And he's like, ah, fuck it. You know, he's just all pissed off. So yeah, he pulls out the planchette and he's like, all right, spirits, I know you know it. Tell me what the winning numbers are tomorrow.
Yeah. And then, like, of course, it doesn't do anything for him. And he's just like, bah, you ain't got no power. And I'm like, oh, my God, I love Pappas. I love him so much.
He spits on it, too. He's like, you ain't got no power. Spits on the planchette. And he crushes his Budweiser can. It's so good.
It's funny. And, like, what's funny, too, is that at that point in the commentary, Roberta Finlay goes, like, he's so stupid. He just leaves the thing open. And, like, I'm like, it's your movie. And so, but so then the green light, the box starts opening up. The green light emanates from there. And then all of a sudden, Pappas starts seeing these, like, creatures crawling on the ground, and then all of a sudden they're on him. And the best comparison I can make them to is the wacky wall crawlers, like the octopus that you used to throw against the wall and they would crawl down slowly.
That's good. Exactly what you're talking about, that because it's almost impossible to describe what these things are.
Yeah,
you have that. This is reason enough. If you're listening to this and still haven't watched it, just watch it to look at these weird slimy creatures, these like tiny little Cthulhu looking squid face things. It's just,
they're all over him, but it'll interchange between they're on him, they're not on him, they're on him, they're not on him. So clearly he's being tricked into thinking these creatures are on him. So if you've seen Hellbound Hellraiser 2, there's a scene where a mental patient is cutting himself because he thinks that there's bugs all over him. The scene is very much like that, because Pappas gets a knife and starts cutting at himself because he thinks he's cutting these wacky wall crawlers off of him.
Yeah.
And it's so good.
It's brutal. So I wanted to go back to that floating skull. You know, I think it's on like on the TV that she's watching tonight, and it also is used to break through the glass. Did Roberta Finlay say anything about that?
She said it was a very hard effect to create, specifically the one of breaking through the glass. She said that they had to do it a number of times because the skull just kept bouncing off of the glass, even though it was it sugar glass that they used for Breakaway? Mm-hmm. And she said they actually shot it through. So the shot is not like head on to the glass with the skull coming through. They actually are shooting a mirror reflection of that coming through.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, because I swear that floating skull was also used in Blood Sisters.
Mm.
And I think it's the skull with, you know, the human eyeballs. And there it's used as like, they kind of rig up like the whole premise is these sorority girls are having an initiation and Blood Sisters. So they go and spend the night in this haunted brothel. And, you know, some of the dudes all rigged it up to scare them. And one of them is they open up this closet, and I swear it's that exact floating skull just drops down. And as soon as I watched it, I was all, that's the skull from the Oracle.
She didn't mention that, but again, like her memory is kind of hazy. She also mumbled a lot of things, and so she may have mentioned something about it and I missed it, but that's interesting. I definitely want to see that.
Yeah, it could just be hoping that's the case, but
yeah. It would make sense. It's economical, you know, you're saving money if you're reusing effects. I just rewatched all of them, because I'd only seen two of them before, but the Blind Dead series, and there is so much reused footage through all four of those movies. It's like, hey, good for you. You reuse it when you got it or whenever you can.
Yeah, I just like Finlay's, you know, she's a cinematographer, so her atmosphere, she does a great job with atmosphere in here in The Oracle. It has like this dreamlike quality, like almost you're the one hallucinating as much as the lead character is.
Yeah.
And it gave me this Shockwaves vibes, and like, just like The Oracle, Shockwaves is not for everybody. And there's no denying, you know, it's slow and everything, but there's also no denying that it puts you in a mood while watching it. And I think it's greatly due to her cinematography, to that hazy, dreamy look of the film, which I felt during the whole runtime, which I just loved.
Who is Shockwaves not for? Who are these people?
Oh, when I get on Letterboxd, when I read some of these reviews of people that I follow, it's they think Shockwaves is, you know, boring and
unfollow. That's
yeah. Well, I like to see, I like to hear everybody's point of view. You know, I like different takes.
God, you're so nice. Fuck.
Another thing that I read on Letterboxd, specific to the Oracle, was everybody's hatred for the Jennifer character. What was her name? Caroline Capers.
Caroline Capers. Yeah.
Every review that I read, they did not like her performance at all.
Well, she's terrible in this movie, but it's hilarious.
She is. She just gives me this, I don't know. She gave me this like Heather Langenkamp vibe from like Nightmare on Elm Street. Like she's the final girl and no one believes her, but she's the only one on the right path. And who knows the truth of the situation. And she gave me this, I don't know. I thought she was perfect in this part. I do think she would enforce why people love or hate this film, but because I like the film, because I like it so much, I'm like, I am into her. What else is she in? And then I look up and then there's nothing. That's it. I'm sure she read all these reviews and it just
ruined
her life. Or her jealous boyfriend did something to her.
I'm guessing it's the boyfriend that had something to do with it. Yeah. She looks, you know, it's funny. It's like her character's name is Jennifer and... I think
Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, Jennifer Connelly.
Okay, yeah, total that. Like when I first saw her, I was like, okay, this is. I know why she was cast. You know, she's got the look.
She's. She's beautiful, but like, she's so earnest when she's got her like scribble notes. Like, I got these messages.
She is so sold on what she's telling people that it's. you know, she's every line she's saying is basically screaming, please believe me. It's just,
yeah.
I feel her pain. And what also adds to her beauty are the outfits.
Yeah.
The outfits in this are, everybody's a fashion icon. It's an 80s explosion. But like I was watching this last weekend and Sarah walked in and she sat down and was like on her phone, but she was like, you know, looking at it for about, you know, looking at the screen for about 10 or 15 minutes. And she's like, they have really good outfits.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's especially like when, at the New Year's party, Jennifer has like this red dress on. And I think even some of the party goers are like, I love your dress. And I was like, me too. That is, that is good. Like poofy sleeve, shoulder pads. It's all there.
Yeah. Yeah. She's always got like the long sleeve poofy shoulder. Like, I don't know. I don't know fashion. So I don't know names of types of blouses, but like it's, I was like Little House on the Prairie blouse because it's like got a neck on it and it's got like poofy, you know, poofy shoulders. But then she'll like pair it with like a long skirt and her hair's very coiffed and just beautiful.
Yeah,
with
the cut.
Yeah, she looks fucking great in this movie. There's so many like great details in this that like all of you people who watched this and reviewed it and were like, this movie's dumb. It's boring. You don't know what you're missing. You don't know how to have fun. And you can just go watch fucking Friday the 13th part 25 for the 10th time again. I don't care. You're missing out. This movie's wonderful.
Yeah. It's just great. I mean, yeah, I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, there's just so much dynamic between all the characters, especially Farkas and Varney. They're like the comedic duo, the mm-hmm. two murderers.
Yeah.
And I am blown away by, you know, how committed to their jobs of being essentially hitmen they are. They're like masters of disguises. You have Farkas dressing up as a maid to mm-hmm. go to a New Year's party to kill Jennifer. And then you have Varney dressing up like a doctor to go into the hospital to kill Jennifer. And of course they're miserable at finishing the job, but they're hilarious. Like when they have their few scenes together and they banter, it's just, you know, Varkas complaining, it's fucking cold out here. You know, just,
she's like, yeah, just, Merry fucking Christmas. Like, I mean, I love her.
What I loved, and it was just a little detail that I picked up, but when she fails as a, you know, she dresses up as a maid and she's not able to kill Jennifer. Mm-hmm. She goes home and calls Varney and she's like, yeah, well, you know, she got away. And then you can't hear what Varney's saying, but you just hear, yeah, you too. And I know Varney said Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Just like, I love these two.
Yeah.
They're so good.
You know, what's funny about that scene too, is like, so, Finlay, when that scene came up, she was like, Oh, I remember this scene. And she said that Pam Latesta, who plays Farkas, had said, well, I should, you know, it'd be more realistic if I like took off, I was undressing while I was on the phone. Cause you know, you get home, you want to get changed out of your clothes. And Finlay's like, no, don't do, no, I don't want, nobody wants to see that. No, we don't want you to do that. And I know, I was like, oh, but she, like, she did it anyway. She started, she like half undressed. So like, you can just see her, like her bra and that's it. But yeah, Finlay was like, no, you don't undress.
Yeah, she's a more committed actress than Jennifer and Ray, who wouldn't do nude scenes.
Right. No chemistry.
Yeah. All the dudes, yeah, like you already pointed out, just exactly alike. They were like, those two guys, Ray and Ben, were just like a poor man's Tom Atkins. Like, they just couldn't tell them apart when they were together mm-hmm. in the same room.
Yeah.
And I thought Mr. Pappas looked a lot like Varney, the other murderer.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, this is bizarro world, and I love it.
Yeah. It's great. Okay, so we both loved it. Lance, what did you end up giving this on Letterboxd?
I gave it 3.5 stars. I will watch it again. I'll probably watch it with Sarah so she can watch all the great outfits. But I could see increasing this rating for sure, because it is damn fun. Just talking about it makes me think 3.5 is not enough.
Yeah, I gave it 3.5 as well, and I'm thinking the same. Like, I'm like, why did I shortchange this movie? Like, I'm going to change in my head. It's 4. I'm just going to say that I changed it to 4.
I'm there too. Okay. 4.
Yeah. Done. 4 is from both of us. And then for a double feature, what would you pair this one with?
Okay. I'm just going to go out and say it. I don't know how you'll feel about it. I think you'll like it. This was before we were doing double features in our first few episodes, but my double feature pick for The Oracle is Luigi Cozzi's The Black Cat.
Huh, okay.
And it's the green glow, the hazy atmosphere. It seems to tie these films together in some weird same universe type of way. And like, I can imagine the witch, Lavanna, I think was her name, using a planchette to communicate.
You'll with die!
The actress. Yeah, basically like, hey, don't play me in this movie. And also the creature gloves in the Oracle are right. The same gloves used in the Black Cat.
Okay.
So everybody go pick up that Black Cat release from Severin. Yeah. Oh, and also that means you get to get Bang Tango.
That's true. You get more Bang Tango in your life, and everyone needs that.
What about you?
Okay, so my double feature is a You Talking to Me double feature.
Oh.
And mine is actually a TV movie called Deadly Messages from 1985. It is a thriller about a woman receiving messages through a Ouija board from a man who was murdered. It is not just a straight, you know, find the killer movie, but it actually has some really neat twists to it about the main character herself and like her identity. It's on YouTube. It's not a great copy, but honestly, most TV movies, there's a lot of them on YouTube and most of them aren't a great copy. But bonus, and I did not know this before I started watching it, this is also a Christmas movie.
Oh.
Yes.
That's a great double feature.
And there's also like, and unfortunately, and a little bit of a spoiler, she's only in the very beginning of the movie, but there is a character, I forgot the character's name. But if you look up Deadly Messages on YouTube, Lance, do that right now while I'm talking. So if you look up Deadly Messages on YouTube, like they always have like a picture from the movie, the woman who is featured on there, she's only there in the beginning of the movie, but it looks like it could be PJ Souls, but with bleached hair and in aerobics gear.
Yeah. And it's got the whole Ouija thing too going mm-hmm. on. You probably already said that, but yeah, that,
yeah.
I see PJ Souls.
All right. So Deadly Messages, 1985 is my double feature. Luigi Cozzi's Black Cat. Fuck, I already forgot what year. 88?
Black Cat, I think, was 89.
89. For Lance's double feature. And with that being said, next month, actually, is January. We're going to do Giallo January. Lance is going to kick us off with his pick. What are we doing?
My pick to kick off Giallo January is 1973's The Corruption of Chris Miller.
Fuck yeah.
Vinegar Syndrome. That's directed by Juan Antonio Bardem. It's a Spanish giallo-style slasher kind of murder mystery. But it is a Vinegar Syndrome release, and it's also streaming on Tubi currently.
Huh.
I did start watching it on Tubi, and it is actually the Vinegar Syndrome 4K restoration. So.
Oh, okay.
But that's about a young woman named Chris Miller, who lives with her stepmother Ruth in a secluded mansion in the countryside. Both Chris and Ruth have been traumatized for different reasons by the disappearance of Chris's father. Their isolation is interrupted when a murderous young hottie, drifter named Barney, wanders up to the house one day, and Ruth takes him in as a handyman to help around the house. All the while, there are brutal murders occurring in the area, and we're left to wonder who the killer is, what happened to Chris's father, and what's truly causing the trauma that both Ruth and her stepdaughter Chris are experiencing. Go in completely blind on this one. Don't even look at the film posters out there, especially the ones currently on Letterboxd, because it does have some elements of spoiling some stuff. Just ignore it all and just press play. You'll be rewarded for it. And because I did watch it recently, and there's even child murder.
Yay!
That is a late Christmas gift for you, Erica.
Yay!
It's, you know what? It's a gift that keeps on giving. I'll take it year round. So yeah. I'm excited. I have this Vinegar Syndrome. It's been sitting on my shelf since last year, and I'm glad I finally have an excuse to watch it. I'm stoked. I'm excited for this one.
Yeah. As of right now, I think it was at about 850 views. So we're still under the 1,000 views. I think it's going to catch up pretty quick with all the, you know, the Black Friday sales arriving to people's houses. So
is it on Shudder too?
It isn't. I don't think it is. I double checked, and I think it was just Tubi.
Just Tubi. Okay. So yeah, but even if it's on Tubi now plus Black Friday, yeah, it's gonna get to 1,000 pretty quickly. So yeah, we're sneaking it right in there. Boom.
Yeah.
Awesome. So if you are not already, please give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd under the username Also Watched. You can also follow my other podcast, Customers Also Watched, on Twitter at CAW Podcast or Facebook or Instagram at Customers Also Watched. And Lance, where can people follow you?
I'm on Letterboxd, Twitter, and Instagram at L Scheibe.
All right. Happy holidays, folks.
Yep. It's the last holiday. Well, no, I guess it's New Year's Eve, but yeah.
Well, yeah.
Kind of close out 2020 with a bang. Be positive and watch a lot of horror movies.
Yes. Stay safe, and we will see you next year, starting with Giallo January.
Bye, everyone.